The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Sadducees and Pharisees, is the 12th of a 15-part series from the exile of the 10 tribes to the reign of Herod. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memories and the Ilui Nishmos Mordechai Aryeh ben Moshe Simcha Halevi Olav HaSholem and Rachel Bas Moshe Yecheskel Olecha HaSholem, Mr. Martin Rose and Mrs. Ruth Rose of blessed memory.
Over the period, the last several weeks, we've seen the emergence of a new order in Jewish life. Beginning in the year of 225 before the Common Era, where a small group of unscrupulous Jews controlled the tax system in Palestine, Eretz Yisrael, and the adjoining areas. And for the next 25 years, they were able to build a large organization of people with wealth, with tendencies to assimilate towards non-Jewish life, and totally without scruples. Even after the right was taken away from them, they had the right under the Egyptians, and Palestine at that point fell under Syrian domination. They maintained their wealth and their power. And finally, 25 years after, even after they lost power, they were able to influence the Syrian government. And the power of the Kohen Gadol was given to them. Jason became the Kohen Gadol. And he introduced a new era of a forced assimilation. 10 years later, we're in the midst of the whole Hanukkah rebellion, where the majority of the Jews, who had very strong sympathies to Jewish tradition, coalesced, this is around Yehuda Maccabee, and fought against them. And essentially, the Hanukkah story and the war was a civil war. It was Jew against Jew, except the assimilated Jews had the power of the Syrian army on their side. The last lecture left off with the death of Yehuda Maccabee. And at that point, this is the point we're going to start tonight. The death of Yehuda Maccabee, in a sense, was the low point of the era. If you turn to the back, we have a timeline. There's a feeling of the dates and what's happening. There are two. We have the event, the Seleucid date. This is the dating which is used in the Book of Maccabees and the Antiquities, which starts from the first Syrian king, Seleucus. And the second is because of the BCE, before the Common Era, which we're more familiar with. And if you notice that from the time of the Hanukkah miracle till the death of Yehuda Maccabee was just some 3 years. And at this point, this is where our story starts. And if you turn back to page 1, this is taken from the Book of Maccabees. It happened after the death of Yehuda that those who had no regard for the law raised their heads all over Israel as they became, they took the political power. And all the wrongdoers reappeared. Now there's a day who had laid low, so to speak, because of the pressure, those who remained in the country, or those who were exiled, but decided now to return. In those days there was a very great famine, and the country went over to their side, because they had the power, so to speak. They had the might and the wealth of the Syrian government. So even those Jews who were non-assimilated, but because of the force of the pressure of the famine, went over to support that government. And Bacchides, who was then the general representing the Syrian government under Demetrius, chose the ungodly men and appointed them masters of the country. So at this point, you had the might of the Syrian army, and the political office was controlled by assimilated Jews. And they searched and sought out the friends of Yehuda and brought them to Bacchides, and he punished them and mocked them. This was the nadir. This was the low point, just some few years after all the victories. It was at this point that those who remained on the side of the Maccabees appointed Yonason. At this point, from the five original sons, two had died. Eliezer died in a battle, just perhaps a year after the Hanukkah story. Yehuda died 3 years afterwards. And now Yonason was given the mantle of leadership. But as soon as he got this mantle, and it was heard that they had a new leader, Bacchides came with his men to attack them. Bacchides was not successful in defeating Yonason outright, but forced him to move to the other side of the Yarden. So at this point, Judea, Palestine proper, was in the hands of the assimilated Jews. And though the Maccabees, the sympathizers of the Maccabees, were forced to live across the other side of the Yarden, which is now in the country of Jordan. The leader of these Jews, of the assimilated Jews, was Alkimus, who was the appointed Kohen Gadol, the high priest, by the Syrians. And as we've explained before, the idea of high priest, the position of high priest, went way beyond the position the Torah created for the Kohen Gadol, but it was a political office. He was the titular head of the Jewish people. And we have on page 1, here in paragraph B, which has high significance. In the 153rd year, this is the year 159 before the Common Era, in the second month, this is the month of Iyar, this is the month of Alkimos gave orders to tear down the wall of the inner court of the sanctuary. It's understood by the commentators that this refers to the, there was a Srug, there was a lattice work wall that separated on the Har HaBayis on the Temple Mount from the area which non-Jews were allowed to go and to the area where only Jews were allowed. And it seems that it's understood that he wanted to tear down that wall, basically to break the symbol, and basically to say that it became an international temple. He thus destroyed the work of the prophets and began to tear it down. At the very time, Alkimus was stricken, and his work hindered, and his mouth stopped, and he was paralyzed. Evidently, he had a stroke. Could no longer utter a word or give orders about his household. So Alkimus died at that time in great agony. What's very significant historically is that when Alkimus died, and when Bacchides saw that Alkimus was dead, he went back to the king, and the land of Yehuda was quiet for 2 years. It seems he was only there at the behest of Alkimus. In other words, it is not that the Syrians wanted to control the country. It was on the contrary, it seems these assimilated Jews wanted to control the country and kept on asking for their help. Once they no longer had a leader of prestige, they just lost interest. They evidently left troops there, but they no longer had that presence because they didn't have the person to urge them on to stay. And as it said, the land was quiet for 2 years, meaning there was no attempt to harm the Maccabees. So there was a status quo. But I hear in paragraph C, in page 2, after 2 years of quiet, again, at the initiation of the assimilated Jews, there was another attempt to destroy the Maccabees. And it starts, then all those, this is again from the book of Maccabees, and all those who disregarded the law plotted, saying, here Yonas and his men are living undisturbed and secure, so now we will bring Bacchides back and we will arrest them all in a single night. That attempt was not successful, though. But he did force the Maccabees, this Bacchides, into a sanctuary called Beth Basi. And he surrounded it, built the siege engines to tear down the walls of this fortress. Yonason is in the second paragraph, was successful and be able to sneak out with a number of his men in the middle of the night, undetected by the Syrians. And he went and started attacking their rear and to attack their sympathizers, the cities that were sympathetic to the Syrians. So he put pressure on their back. And Shimon, one of the, actually at this time he was the remaining living brother, because a third brother, Yochanan, in the interim had also been killed. So at this point, three of the original brothers had been killed. He was able to successfully fight against those who were trying to directly attack the fortress. And you notice in the bold print, and they pressed him very hard, for his plan and his attack were in vain. In other words, the Maccabees pressed them and they were not able to succeed. And at that point, Bacchides became very frustrated. He was very angry with the men who disregarded the law, these assimilated Jews, who had advised him to come into the country. And he killed many of them and resolved to go back to his country. And Yonason learned of it, and he sent envoys to him to make peace with him and obtain the release of his prisoners. Prisoners had been taken from the Maccabees. There were prisoners on both sides. And he agreed and did as he promised and made oath to him they would not seek to injure him so long as he lived. And he released to him the prisoners he had taken before from the land of Yehuda. And he went away and returned to his own country and did not come into their borders again. So the sword ceased in Israel. And Yonason lived in Michmash. This is in Judea, north, it seems north of Yerushalayim. And Yonason began to judge the people and to destroy the ungodly out of Israel. At this point, he was able, because of the truce that was made, he was able to move back into Judea proper, but he was not able to enter Yerushalayim. There was still the fortress there, the citadel that's constantly referred to, and we'll see further on, that was manned by Syrian soldiers and assimilated Jews. And it was impossible for him to move into Yerushalayim, but he created a nation within a nation, so to speak. And where he could, and where these Jews did not have the defenses of the Syrian forces, he was able to at least to convert the countryside back to traditional observance. This was the order of things for some 5 years. As I turn to page 3, in paragraph A, in the 160th year, this is 5 years after the truce of Bacchides, as things were quiet, Yonason was consolidating his position, but not in control of the country as a whole. There was a great upheavals within Syria itself. I just like to summarize exactly what had happened, up until this point. The Syrian king that wrested control from the Egyptians, approximately the year 200 before the Common Era, and was able to make Syria make Palestine a Syrian province, was Antiochus III. He had two sons, Seleucus and Antiochus IV, Jr. After Antiochus III's death, Seleucus, the older brother, became king. After Seleucus' death, Antiochus, the younger son, the younger brother, became king. When Antiochus died, Antiochus had a son, again by the name of Antiochus. Everything so made sense so far. Seleucus, the older brother of Antiochus, the villain of the Hanukkah story, had a son, Demetrius, who escaped from Rome where he was being held hostage, raised an army, and killed this Antiochus V, the son of the villain. It was this under Demetrius, now this new king, that Bacchides was sent, Yehuda Maccabee was killed, Yonasan finally made a truce with his Bacchides. It was all under the reign of this Demetrius, the son of Seleucus. There was a fellow who claimed to be a son of Antiochus IV, the villain of the Hanukkah story. His name was Alexander. There is a question of historians, was he an imposter or was truly the son of this Antiochus? Whatever it was, he was able to raise an army and to challenge this Demetrius. So basically what is a war of cousins. Demetrius was the son of one brother, Seleucus, and this Alexander was the son of another brother. This is Antiochus. You have two brothers, Seleucus and Antiochus, two sons, Demetrius, this Alexander. Alexander now claimed that he wanted to be the king. So this is how it starts. And this turn of events had a major benefit for Jews in general, Yonasan in particular. Yes?
I'm sorry, just last week, but how long after this story of Hanukkah did they maintain Jewish life?
So, yeah, they were able to maintain Yerushalayim for approximately two and a half years. At the time when Demetrius came to the throne, and he put pressure, it was probably 3 years when the time Yehuda Maccabee was killed. At that point, Yerushalayim no longer was in their hands. So we have the Hanukkah story and the victory. Basically, all the victory assured was A, that the temple basically would still be functioning. You have to realize that it stopped functioning for 3 years before the Hanukkah story and it made into a pagan temple. After the victory of Hanukkah, it started again, resumed its role as a Beis HaMikdash and continued so without interruption. The second was that the Gzeros...
For the next 10 years or just for those 3 years?
No, continue. It seems that there was no...
But they weren't in Yerushalayim.
They were not in Yerushalayim, but the Avoda still kept on going as they tolerated it. As they were again, probably they were afraid, again, if they pushed too hard, again they're going to get this tremendous revolt. So that much they kept. And second, what occurred was that the Gzeres, the decrees to forcibly force them not to observe Mila, Shabbos, and other things, were abandoned. So this is really what the victory of Hanukkah accomplished. It did not accomplish, as we see clearly, political independence. Yet from it seemed, and from the Gemara and even from Josephus, that from the next year on, Hanukkah was observed. So even when they were in hiding and they were on the other side of the Jordan, Jews across the world observe Hanukkah because they realize that even besides these political setbacks, that there was some permanence at least to what was achieved. This next section, though, gives us a sense of what was not achieved by the Hanukkah victory. I'm going to just start again. Let me read here from the Book of Maccabees. In the 160th year, Alexander Epiphanes, the son of Antiochus, went up and took possession of Ptolemais, that's Akko. So here is Alexander who's challenging Demetrius, the son of Antiochus, the villain of Hanukkah's story. And they welcomed him, and he became king there. After Akko was very close to Yerushalayim, and to Michmash, to Judea. When King Demetrius heard of it, he mustered very strong forces and went out to meet him in battle. And at this point, Demetrius was afraid that Yonasan would join forces with he's right there. and he may join forces with him. And Demetrius sent letters to Jonathan, Eunice, in peaceful terms to flatter him, for he said to himself, let us be the first to make peace with him before he makes peace with Alexander against us. For we remember all the wrongs we have done him and his brothers and his nation. And it continues on, what did he do? And he gave him authority to muster troops, as in the bold print, and to procure arms and to be his ally. Before, he didn't have this. He had no right. It was still, even though there was a truce, he was a citizen of Syria. He had no right to maintain an independent army. In other words, all that he was able, as was said in the end of the last paragraph, he began to judge the people and heard the ungodly out of Israel, was more in the role of a policeman rather than a general. And he gave orders that they should turn over to him the hostages that were in the citadel. Part of what had happened was that in order to secure peace, which was common in antiquity, it was uncommon even in the Middle Ages, they took hostages, relatives of the people who were in leadership, and it was a form of blackmail, so to speak, right? That if you would revolt, these people would be killed. So he gave orders that all the relatives, all these people that were held hostage, should be turned back to their families. So just understanding what had happened here and how little power they had. This already is the 160. This is 12 years after the victory of Hanukkah, and they still did not have the right to bear arms. So Yonason went up to Jerusalem and read the letters in the hearing of all the people and of the men who were in possession of the citadel, and they were dreadfully frightened when they heard that the king had given him authority to muster troops. And the men in the citadel turned over the hostages to Yonason, and he gave them back to their parents. And Yonason lived in Jerusalem. Now he moves back to Jerusalem and began to build and renovate the city. And it continues on, skip, and the foreigners who were in the strongholds of Bacchides had built fled. So now basically foreign soldiers started leaving en masse Israel. So really the only one who had now a standing army was Yonason. Each one left his post, went back to his own country, except that in Beth Sur, in his base Sur, there were left some of those who had forsaken the law and the commandments, but served as a refuge for them. So you had the citadel in Jerusalem, who had foreigners, and who had these assimilated Jews, and in the citadel in the fortress of Beth Sur. But besides these two fortresses, the land as a whole, I mean around Jerusalem, was in the hands of Yonason. Now, we have now in section, in paragraph B, we have that Alexander did not want to be outbid by Demetrius. And Alexander heard all the promises Demetrius had sent to Yonason. They related to him the battles and exploits that he and his brothers had performed and the troubles they'd endured. And he said to himself, can we find another man like him? Notice he wanted now, he was afraid now that Yonason would join forces with Demetrius. Now we must make him our friend and ally. So he wrote letters and sent to him in the following terms. King Alexander sends greetings to his brother Yonason. We have heard that you are a valiant warrior and fit to be our friend. Now we have today appointed you to be high priest of your nation. Because now this was an official appointment. Up until now, and this is just from the history here, when Antiochus came to power, he appointed first Jason. 3 years later, he appointed Menelaus. Menelaus was eventually killed, but in his place, now this Alcimus was appointed high priest. He was the official governmental personage in Judea. After Alcimus died, there was no replacement, evidently. So now Yonason gets an official position. And to be called friend of the king, and he sent him a purple robe and a gold crown, and again to side with us and maintain friendly relations with us. Now on page 4, we have, again, on paragraph C, this is a Now, this is basically, it became an auction here. Who could outbid who? So King Demetrius in turn now wanted to cull Ioannis's favor. And it's very significant historically to see what he wanted to offer him, what was the condition of Jewry at that time. And he said, this is, "For I will free you from the greatest part of the tributes and taxes which you formerly paid to the kings, my predecessors, and to myself." So these, actually, he was doing this all along. "And I do now set you free from those tributes which you have ever paid, and besides, I forgive you tax upon salt, and the value of the crowns which you used to offer to me." From the commentators in Antiquities, it seems that originally there was a custom at certain times to give gold crowns to the king. Later on, it was substituted. One did not have to give the actual crown, but a monetary substitute of that. And this was all part of the taxes. "And instead of the third parts of the fruits of the field and half of the fruits of the trees, I relinquish my part of them from this day." In other words, whatever they made, half of the fruits and a third of the thing went to the government. I hope the IRS doesn't read this. "And as to the poll money, which ought to be given me for every head of the inhabitants of Judea, I relinquish to you for this time and for all time to come." In other words, we have in a sense of what he wanted to offer, what the burden of taxation was. Unfortunately, Demetrius, who made this offer, did not win the war. So it would seem Alexandria did not make a counteroffer, and it seemed the Jews were stuck with those facts. But it just gives you a sense, when we speak in terms of the victory of Hanukkah and their independence, you see, this is 12 years later, and they're still paying considerable, I mean, it's considerable taxes. Yet, even despite his Ioannis's successes, you find in paragraph D here on page 4, in the second, in section D, in the second paragraph, "Then King Alexander, who was the victor, wrote to Ioannis to come to meet him, and he went in splendor to Ptolemais." In other words, Ioannis went in splendor. "And met the kings, and gave them and their friends silver and gold and many gifts, and was well received by them." In other words, the people came, it was a whole procession. I guess Ioannis came, Alexander came, I think Ptolemy, the two kings, is Ptolemy, who became an ally of Alexander, was there. So you have King Ptolemy of Egypt, you have Alexander, who at that point was his son-in-law. These are the two kings, and Ioannis, who was just a Kohen Gadol, or at least the title of Kohen Gadol, was well received by them. And in the bold print, "But some malcontents from Israel, who disregarded the law," again the assimilated Jews, "gathered against them to lay charges against him." Because they were not totally defeated. Again, they wanted to get the position of power. "But the king paid no attention to them, and the king gave orders, and they took Ioannis's clothes off and clothed him in purple. They did as he ordered, and the king made him sit beside him. And said to his officers, 'Go out with him to the middle of the city and make a proclamation. No one is to appeal against him on any ground, and no one must interfere with him on any account.'" So his, at this point, as we see, says the position of Ioannis was much cemented. But despite this, he still had this tremendous burden of taxes, and the citadel was still occupied by these assimilated Jews. Now, in section, on page 5, section E, this where now is 7 years later. And again, there was a whole change of the political order. And this Demetrius, the son of Seleucus, who was displaced, had a son, Demetrius II. And the year, and this is the year 167 in the Greek reckoning, which is the year 145 before the Common Era, Demetrius became king. In the whole tumult of the wars and counter wars, Ioannisson wanted to take the opportunity to displace the people in the citadel. And evidently, they were strongly armed, and the citadel was built to withstand such pressures. So in those days, Ioannisson mustered the men of Yehuda to attack the citadel. He set up many siege engines against it. And some breakers of the law who hated their own nation went to the king and reported to him that Ioannisson was besieging the citadel. You have to realize that these people could have just left. I mean, it was just as others had left beforehand. The reason they still wanted to maintain the reins of power. And that's why they kept this presence here. They didn't want to join what would be traditional Jewry. They didn't want to leave the country. Because they had the choice of just leaving the country and assimilating in some other place. They wanted to stay there, and they wanted to put pressure on Ioannisson. They hoped eventually power would come back to their hands. When he heard of it, he was angry, Demetrius, because he had no right. This was not in the treaties that were signed beforehand. But upon hearing it, he immediately set out and came to Ptolemais and wrote Ioannisson not to continue the siege, but to meet him as soon as possible, Ptolemais, for a conference. When Ioannisson heard this, he gave orders to continue the siege, and he selected some of the elders of Israel and the priests and put himself in danger, for he took silver and gold and clothing and great many other presents and went to the king of Ptolemais, and he pleased the king. And when some of the men of his nation who disregarded the law complained of him, the king treated him just as his predecessors had done and showed him great honor in the presence of all his friends. He confirmed him in the high priesthood and all the other honors he had received before and made him chief of his best friends, evidently an honorific title. Ioannisson asked the king to free Yehuda and the three provinces and Samaria from tribute. These are the adjoining provinces, and promised him 300 talents. The king agreed and wrote a letter to Ioannisson on all these matters. So the regular tribute, this is only one part of the taxes, was taken off in discharge for one lump sum. But he did not yet give Ioannisson the power to displace the men in the citadel. All he did was, basically, he gave something to everyone. And as to Ioannisson, he said, you can't have the citadel. He still wanted to maintain some sort of a force there. Evidently, the people, the assimilated Jews, still had some influence of the court. On the other hand, because of Ioannisson's power, he still wanted to cement his friendship. But in subsequently, in section F, when Demetrius was having internal problems, and Ioannisson was having problems from the men of the citadel. Again, they just didn't sit idly by. They used to go out at night and attack the people in Yerushalayim, and so put pressure on them. So Ioannisson sent to King Demetrius and asked him to expel the garrison of the citadel from Yerushalayim and the garrisons from the strongholds because they kept fighting against Israel. And again, Demetrius again kept on, kept his original stance and said, I will not do this for you and your nation, but I'll greatly honor you and your nation if I find any opportunity. So now please send me men who will fight for me, for all my troops are in revolt. But he lied in all that he had said and became estranged from Ioannisson, did not return the favors he had done him, but treated him very harshly. After the war, after Demetrius was not in such danger, they became estranged. But again, a new problem arose.
What was Demetrius' relationship to Ptolemy?
He was a son-in-law at one time. Originally, this Alexander,
was the son of Antiochus, or the status son of the Antiochus the villain, became a son-in-law of this Ptolemy. He didn't like his son-in-law. He schlepped the wife away and gave him to this, you know, the second Demetrius. And there's just a lot of, you know, there's a lot of a lot of marital but again, as we had, again, just remembering the story here, we had Alexander, the son of Antiochus, the villain of the Chronicles story, right, who was displaced by this second Demetrius, the son of Demetrius, right, who was the son of Seleucus, the brother of Antiochus. This Alexander had a son. Now, people, they don't keep quiet over here. He said, "You got problems." This Antiochus, in other words, the son of Alexander, felt this little girl. The people around felt he's the one who should be the king. And he had a general by the name of Trypho, who put pressure on Demetrius. So in paragraph G, we find that Trypho was able to displace Demetrius. And says that in paragraph H, which is a significant event, and Trypho undertook to become king of Asia and assume the diadem, the crown, and to raise his hand against King Antiochus. Now, he was only a child, this Antiochus, the son of Alexander. And Trypho, who really was the regent, who was the one who was controlling the thing, wanted to do away with him. But he was afraid that Ioannison would not permit him to, because Ioannison already had a standing army. In great detail, the Book of Maccabees described the heroic feats of Ioannison, fighting against the nations around him. So he was a force to contend with. And he was afraid that had Trypho tried to take power, Ioannison would go against him. So he undertook to seize him, to seize Ioannison, in order to destroy him. And he set out and came to Bashan. And when he came to there and they met, and ostensibly the reason was for peace, and Ioannison came with him, and they took the road from Bashan, which is near the Jordan, and he went all the way to Ptolemais, which is by the Mediterranean. And when Ioannison entered Ptolemais, the people of Ptolemais closed the gates and seized him. When Ioannison came, he came just with a small entourage of soldiers. Unbeknownst to him that there was a trap, he was taken alive, but all who had come in with him, they put to the sword. He was held as a hostage, and eventually Trypho killed Ioannison. At this point, they were without a leader. This is in section I, and Shimon heard that Trypho had gathered a strong force to invade the land of Yehuda, to destroy it utterly. And he saw that the people were trembling and alarmed, and he went to Yerushalayim, and he came to them, and he prayed, and he gave them much inspiration, much courage. They went out to attack Trypho. They were able to rebuff him. At this time, and again, there's a difference in the accounts between Antiquities and the Book of Maccabees, but this Demetrius, who had been defeated, according to the Book of Maccabees, had not been killed. And he was still a force to reckon with, putting pressure on Trypho. And Shimon chose men, now in section J, and sent them to King Demetrius. They should give the country relief, because all that Trypho did was to plunder. Thus he wanted help now from Demetrius, and Demetrius sent him a message in these terms and answered him and wrote a letter as follows. King Demetrius sends greeting to Shimon, the high priest, the friend of kings, and to the Jewish elders and nation. The gold crown and palm branch which you sent, as you gave a present, we have received, ready to make a lasting peace with you and to write to our officials to grant you the immunities you ask. The things we have guaranteed to you stand assured. The strongholds which you have built shall be yours. Any oversights and deficiencies up to this time we forgive, as well as the crown tax that you owe. And if any other tax was collected in Yerushalayim, it shall no longer be collected. If any of you are suitable persons to be enrolled at our court, they shall be so enrolled. There shall be peace between us. This was the official peace treaty, and at this point, Judea, Yehuda became an independent nation. In other words, not at the Hanukkah victory, but really, says, at this point. It was at the 170th year that the yoke of the heathens was lifted from Israel. And the people began to write in their contracts and agreements in the first year of Simon of Shimon, the great high priest and governor and commander of the Jews. This really is the beginning of the Malchus Hashmonaim. This is really the beginning of the independent government. And if you know, you turn back to the timeline in terms of the dates, from the time of Hanukkah to the time of the of this period, is we have 22 years. It's a considerable chunk of time. And really, as we see clearly, that independence was really achieved much later, after many deaths, many wars. And finally, we have in section K that the men in the city of Yerushalayim were being, this is the last vestige of what had been the origins of this whole Hanukkah story, were being kept from going in and out of the country to buy and sell, and they were famished, and they refused to leave, and a good many of them died of starvation. They cried out to Simon to make terms with them, and he did so. And he expelled them from it and purified the citadel from its defilements. And they had a whole simcha to describe. And this date, when they left, the 23rd date of the second month, is mentioned not only in the Book of Maccabees, but is mentioned in the Megillus Tainus as one of those official days that one was not allowed to fast. And it continues, as we see, as soon as he was able to consolidate his position, as it says, the land of this is towards the end of the Book of Maccabees, and the land of Yehuda was at peace as long as Simon lived. He sought the good of his nation. His rule and his renown pleased them all his life. There was no one left in the land to fight them. The kings were destroyed in those days. He reestablished all those of his people who had been humbled. He sought out the law and removed everyone who was lawless and wicked. He made the sanctuary glorious and increased the equipment of the sanctuary. This, in essence, really of this early period of the Maccabees, was really the most glorious part, these 8 years. And as we see clearly, that at least openly, those assimilated Jews no longer, at least had abandoned their practice, either left or abandoned their practice. However, and this is very significant to understand historically what happened, it seemed that the assimilated Jews did not suddenly become more religious. They just, in a sense, assimilated to what would became the dominant culture at that time. Traditional Judaism was the dominant culture, and they assimilated to that as part of nationhood. In a sense, just like as it's very common from people who different walks of life have a turkey at Thanksgiving or celebrate the 4th of July as part of just is one's national sentiments. They celebrated Pesach and Sukkot, but it's just as part of what we call the national religion, not in the sense that they were religious people. And it seems that these people were very much, these people of what would be power and wealth, were very much there, but were under the surface. And in fact, as we're going to see, that Shimon himself was killed by one of these people, and it happened to be his son-in-law. This is how it's described in the Book of Antiquities in Josephus. This is in section M. Now he was the leader of the Jews in all 8 years, but at a feast came to its end. It was caused by the treachery of his son-in-law Ptolemy, who caught also his wife and two of his sons and kept them in bonds. He also sent some to kill Yochanan, the third son, whose name was Hyrcanus. But the young man, perceiving them coming, he avoided the danger he was in from them and made haste into the city Yerushalayim. as relying of the goodwill of the multitude because of the benefits they had received from his father and because of the hatred the same multitude bare to Ptolemy. So when Ptolemy was endeavoring to enter the city by another gate, they drove him away as having already admitted of Hyrcanus. It seems, though, if Hyrcanus had not been so fast, there were enough people there to do away with Hyrcanus. And if Ptolemy had been a little faster and been able to go into the city, it seems he would have been a menace in the city itself. As the historian of Isaac Halevi points out, evidently there were enough people that were sympathetic to Ptolemy and the type of person he was that would have caused a lot of trouble. The multitude of the people, the bulk of the people, pushed him away. But it seems that when he went there, he went with the intention of finding sympathizers. So this is even after 8 years of peaceful rule, there still was a significant body of people who were very far removed from Yiddishkeit, at least if not outwardly so, but inwardly so. And that really brings us to the era of the Tzedukim. If one reads the history, and it's on page 8, if one reads the history of the period, up until the time, in the period right before the Hanukkah story and the years shortly after the Hanukkah, these 22 years after the Hanukkah story, we hear of the Misyavnim, the assimilated Jews. No mention of Tzedukim, just Misyavnim. After the reign of Yochanan Hyrcanus, the son of Simon, Shimon, the last surviving member of the Maccabees, we find this whole powerful group called Sadducim. Where did they come from? Who were they? It's a contention, as we're going to see from the sources we're going to bring, from Isaac Halevi, that these Sadducim were actually these assimilated Jews. They were not very well educated. They're in terms of Torah. You have to realize that there are these 22 years, they were not sitting in yeshivas. And in the years before, when they ascended to power, there weren't many yeshivas there either. But these people were still in place. They had decided that it was in their interests to remain as Jews, but their sentiments and their feelings were basically as they were before. So what happened was that they formed a whole group, and they called themselves Sadducim. They gave themselves some sort of a form, but basically it's the same people. What we're first going to look at now is the history of the Sadducim, at least as it interfaced is in the role of the history, the political history. And then we're going to go into the original sources and see what kind of people they were, what were their beliefs, what kind of a life did they lead. There was an incident which in itself really changed the whole course of Jewish history. And if one could point to one incident in this era, the era we're speaking about, that had such tremendous power, that would change basically the whole political balance, that would eventually lead to the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, to Roman occupation, it was this particular incident. And let me just give a little background to this before we start reading through the original sources. The Maccabees were Kohanim. They eventually took the position of Kohen Gadol. This Yochanan became Kohen Gadol. And it seems not only just as an honorific position, but actually he became the functioning Kohen Gadol. From the sources that we have of him, at least originally in his reign, he was a very great person. There's a Gemara in Soita in Lamed Gimel, and the story is repeated in Antiquities by Josephus, that he was a Baal Ruach HaKodesh. He was a person of the who was able to hear a bas kol, was to hear a voice from heaven. He was a person that the Chachomim of the era had tremendous trust in, and it seems, you know, the Chachomim of that, the leaders, we don't know the names of the people, the leaders of this era of Yochanan was Yeshua ben Prachya, Nitai Har Bailey, as they're mentioned in Pirkei Avos. These were the leaders of the period. However, there was a rumor going around as to the status of the kahuna, the eligibility of priesthood of this Yochanan. And the reason being, a woman who has a who has an affair or has some relations with a non-Jew cannot marry a Kohen. And if she does marry a Kohen, the child is a cholol, is no longer eligible for the role of being a priest. He is nischalol, he has become desanctified. Rabbinically, if there's a situation where one has good cause to fear that this occurred, if a woman was held hostage, was a captive, she's a shvuya, where there is a distinct likelihood in that situation that she may have been compromised by the goyim. Rabbinically, even though really we have no proof as to what happened, we just know, at least we have witnesses that she was taken a prisoner, but we have no witnesses what happened subsequently. Rabbinically, they are afraid of at least the certain percentage of times that relations will occur, and declare that that these women cannot marry Kohanim, and if they do marry Kohanim, the children are invalid for the priesthood. It's a rabbinic law. Midrash, according to the Torah, if we did not see what occurred, the law of chazakah, the law of status quo, is applied, that we don't, you're innocent until proven guilty. So even though intellectually there may be concern, but just like in a court of law, there has to be proof, so too her status of eligibility to marry a Kohen is not marred unless there's proof. That's the Torah law. Rabbinic law is that because in this situation where she may have been compromised, she's a shvuya, she's been captured, she is not allowed to marry a Kohen. There was a rumor to the fact that Yochanan's mother, during the upheavals of Antiochus, was taken a captive prior to the birth of Yochanan. If it is true she was taken a captive, regardless of what happened, but at least rabbinically she would not be allowed to marry a Kohen, and Yochanan therefore, if this would be true, would not be eligible to be a Kohen. As we're going to see in the story, is that there were witnesses to the fact, but the witnesses were eventually perjured or contradicted, and the testimony was thrown out. But there was some concern to his eligibility. So here we have a situation where he's of the most prestigious family. He's from the Maccabees. He's a survivor. He's at this point, he is a tzaddik, a very righteous person, a person who is allowing his country to follow the laws of the Torah, and yet there is this pallor, this chshad, this suspicion that hung over him. That's one thing to just before we read the sources. The other thing to keep in mind is, as we said, and as we're going to see from the sources, the former Misyavnim, these former assimilated Jews, just became like the wolf in sheep's clothing, just changed their clothing. They assimilated what became now the dominant culture, Yiddishkeit, but they were not really a changed people. This Yochanan did not felt for the good of the country that it was not a time to practice kanoyas, was to practice this, to stamp these people out, to see how to give tests of their religiosity. He felt if these people would be tolerated, if you'd be makar of these people, bring them closer, they would eventually find their way back to Yiddishkeit. That was his approach. So therefore, he led a lifestyle that he felt would be appealing to these people. And it seems even Shimon, his father, seems to have conducted himself in a grandiose manner with tremendous wealth. And there's sources of this in the Book of Maccabees. To the extent and effect that the other kings around were jealous of him. But it seems for the express purpose that all segments of society were able to look up to him, and therefore he would have been able to have influence over them. But it's a two-edged sword. At one time you're being makar of these people, but there's a question, to what extent are these people having effect on him as well? And that really, these two factors, the idea of the shvui, of the captive woman, and Yochanan's good relations with these former Misyavnim, called Tzedukim now, is really the backdrop of this story. And I think that's really similar that we read this. This is taken from this section on page 8, is taken from Antiquities, from Josephus. However, this prosperous state of affairs moved the Jews. When Josephus writes of these, his historical sources, it seems, were written by Tzedukim. This happened much before he was born, Josephus. And he had to really cull from other sources. The sources that he's taking from, and it seems his own personal bias as well, seem to be that of the Tzedukim. So one has to just to take that in mind when one reads this. But the prosperous state of affairs moved the Jews to envy Hyrcanus, which seems a little absurd that they should, you know, people should envy their king. There's more pride of the king. But they were the worst disposed. But the worst disposed them were the Pharisees, who were one of the sects of the Jews, as we have informed you already. The Pharisees were the Rabbonim. These were the leaders of Jews from time immemorial. But once the Tzedukim became a factor and wanted to wrest the reins of power in society from what would have been the traditional areas of power, those who resisted and ones that they wanted to displace were another sect, so to speak, just another group. In fact, what we're dealing with are the Rabbonim. They have so great a power over the multitude that when they say anything against the king or against the high priest, they are presently believed. This basically was written by Tzedukim, but one really sees, again, and these are the words of Josephus, there's this tendency to look down at the multitude. You know, there's just the riffraff. You know, there's the Tzedukim, these are the people that count. And there's the Rabbonim, this intellectual group, this elite group. Then the multitude, which could be make up 98% of the people. But he just looked at them, these are nobodies. But in terms of these, what we see, 98% of the people, their leadership was the Pharisees. So these are really not a sect, these are the leadership, and these are the people. The Tzedukim were really, these were the Misyavnim. They looked at people as an opportunity to tax, to use, rather than to help. Now Hyrcanus was a disciple of theirs, of the Pharisees, the Purushim, and greatly beloved by them. And when he was once invited to them to a feast and entertained them very kindly, this is the version that he says, we're going to read a version from the Gemara which is slightly different. When he saw them in good humor, he began to say to them that they knew he was desirous to be a righteous man, to do all the things whereby he might please Hashem, which was the profession of the Pharisees also. However, he desired, if they observed him offending in any point and going out of the right way, they would call him back and correct him. Basically, what you find, this is a tzaddik who wants techocha. This is a righteous person who wants direction. on which occasion they attested to his being entirely virtuous, with which commendations he was well pleased. But still there was one of his guests there whose name was Eliezer, a man of an ill temper. Again, this is the version written by the Sadducim themselves. And delighting in seditious practices. This man said that since you desire to know the truth, if you will be righteous and earnest, lay down the high priesthood and content thyself with civil government of the people. And when he desired to know for what cause he ought to lay down the high priesthood, the other replied, "We have heard it from old men that your mother had been a captive under the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes." This story was false, and Hyrcanus was provoked against him, and all the Pharisees had a very great indignation against him. That was because it was only a rumor, and it was proven to be false. Now there was one Yoinason, a very great friend of Hyrcanus's, but of the sect of the Sadducees, whose notions are quite contrary to those of the Pharisees. And we're going to go in detail of this soon. He told Hyrcanus that Eliezer had cast such a reproach upon him, according to the common sentiments of all Pharisees. In other words, he was saying that really what Eliezer had verbalized was the true sentiments of the Pharisees. Now, this whole indignation was just a show. The Pharisees really believe that you are not a Kohen Gadol, because they maintain that the testimony is true, even though, according to Torah law, the testimony does not mean that he is invalid, but rabbinic law would dictate that he would be invalid. And that this would be made manifest if he would ask them the question what punishment they thought this man deserved, for that he might depend on it that the reproach was not laid on him with their approbation. If they were for punishing him as his crime deserved. In other words, if they would really punish him, then it would be indicative that it was not just a farce. So the Pharisees made answer he deserved stripes and bonds, but it did not seem right to punish reproaches with death. In other words, you can't kill a person for it. There's a question about the thing of Malchus to be given, but all of them, death would not be deserved. And indeed, the Pharisees, even upon other occasions, are apt to give severe punishment. At this gentle sentence, Hyrcanus was very angry and thought this man reproached him by their approbation. In other words, that they, it was this Yoinason who chiefly irritated him and influenced him so far that eventually that he made him leave the party of the Pharisees, abolish the decrees that they had imposed on the people. Now, the decrees they imposed on the people is what he basically abolished was all rabbinical enactments. You have to realize that Sadducim were not very religious people, even though that Yoinason himself was still a very religious man. But the influence they had over him was such, they said that really that they had overstepped their power, and they really have no right, this was the Sadducees, to make all this rabbinical legislation, and it should be abrogated. So what he did was that he issued the effect is that all rabbinical legislation is no longer binding, and to punish those that observe them. From this source arose that hatred which he and his sons met with from the multitude. Again, it's always the multitude. I mean, this is the people, because the people accepted this. But of these matters we shall speak hereafter. And he says, "But what I now explain is this, that the Pharisees have delivered to the people a great many observances by succession from their fathers, which are not written in the law of Moses." And it's clear from this, basically what they're referring to, this new legislation, these new observances, were not Mosaic observances, are the Drabbonans. It was for that reason is that the Sadducees reject them and say that we're to esteem those observances to be obligatory, which are in the written word, but are not to be observed, which are derived from the traditions of our forefathers. Notice what he had done in one clean swoop was saying, well, if the only reason his mother would be invalid would be because of rabbinic legislation about the captured woman, and if we invalidate all rabbinical law, And since according to Torah law, he's fine, so be it. So what he did was he undercut, in other words, he cemented his position as Kohen Gadol by destroying the means, in other words, of the right that the Rabbonim had to make such legislation. He says it's invalid. And not only is it invalid, but anyone who observes any rabbinic law will be severely punished. Really, that was the... And concerning these things, he goes, it is that great disputes and differences have arisen among us, while the Sadducees are able to persuade none but the rich, and have not the populace obsequious to them. But the Pharisees have the multitude on their side. But if these two sects and that of the Essenes I have treated accurately in the second book of Jewish Affairs. So what happened was that this Hyrcanus abrogated really all drabonins, all rabbinic law. And as a result, really started a whole new era in Jewish life. If you just turn to page 10, just because I don't want to go through the whole... Yeah, yeah. The last surviving son of the Maccabees was Simon, was Shimon. He had a son, Yochanan, whose name was Yochanan Hyrcanus. So this was Hyrcanus, it was either it's Yochanan or Hyrcanus. He was known as Yochanan Kohen Gadol. There's a question of there may be two Yochanan Kohen Gadol, but his name was always Yochanan Kohen Gadol. Is Yochanan. As Hyrcanus. Sometimes it's John, sometimes it's Hyrcanus. And John is Yochanan. Right, this is one generation after the thing of the Maccabees. He reigned for 31 years, but by the time it's not clear to pinpoint when this occurred. It seems towards the end of his reign, but by the end of his reign already, the Tzedukim again, in other words, in a new guise, these assimilated Jews were again held the reign of the reins of power. The Gemara states the same story, slightly differently, basically the same story. The name of the king is Yanai, which according to the Gemara, in at least according to Abaye and the Gemara in Brachos, is one and the same as Yochanan. What happened to him is slightly different, and I'd just like to, on page 10, we'll skip the, it's basically the same thing. The names are slightly different. But on page 10, in the last paragraph, the sages, as a result, punish Yehuda ben Gedidia, in other words, the name of the Pharisee, and according to the Gemara's account, is not Eliezer, but it says Yehuda ben Gedidia, and the friend of, according to this, the friend of Yochanan, the Tzeduki had so much influence over him, who created this whole new turn of events, his name was Eliezer ben Pu'ira. So as the sage result punished Yehuda ben Gedidia and excommunicated him, Eliezer provoked the king further and said, excommunication is a fit punishment when a commoner is falsely accused, but for a king and high priest this punishment is not sufficient. What shall I do? Asked the king. If you would... Yeah, it was Moshe Shemra. There are certain precedents to give Malkus on a Moitzi Shemra, the Zigmar Kedushin Chof Ches, and it would be in that order. If you would listen to my advice, Eliezer continued, you should crush them, the sages. What will become of the Torah, asked Yanai? The Torah is neatly rolled and sitting in the corner. Anyone who wants to avail themselves of it can do so, replied Eliezer. The evil sprouted through Eliezer, Poira, and they, the Sadducees, and Yanai, killed out the vast majority of the sages. So it wasn't just now the question of the enacted laws, as we have in the story to forbid the practice of rabbinic law, but in the process, they killed out the rabbinic leaders. Perhaps it was a secondary stage. In other words, first that they abrogated the laws, and the Rabbonin resisted, you know, the Horig Val Yavar, that they felt it was a Shas HaShmad, but they resisted, but they were basically killed out. The world was desolate until Shimon ben Shetach came and returned the Torah to its former greatness. There is a question. There's a problem. Is this the same one, or there are two Yochanans? Right. Because his reign is only 30 years, and he didn't, I don't know if he lived even 80 years, because his mother was born around the time of the of Antiochus. Antiochus became the king in the year 175 before the Common Era. Yochanan Hurgas died in the year 104 before the Common Era. And Antiochus didn't start all these practices until well after he became king, so the years really aren't there. So it is problematic if this actually is one and the same person, but it is discussed. Yes. We don't have their names. We're going to see next time Yeshua ben Prachya, who was the leader of the Sanhedrin at that time, ran away to Alexandria. He was saved. They killed out most of the Rabbanan, a considerable number of Rabbanan. Some of them were saved. But we do not have their names. I would just like to conclude now, just to give an insight of who these people were, what was their philosophy. I would just, before we read the thing, I'd just turn to page 12. In section B, and both of these are taken from Josephus. The first section, B, is taken from Antiquities, and C is from the Wars of the Jews. At this time, there were three sects among the Jews who had different opinions concerning human actions. The one was called the sect of the Pharisees, another the sect of the Sadducees, and the other the sect of the Essenes. Now, for the Pharisees, they say that some actions, but not all, are the word of fate. In other words, hashgacha, or mazel. And some of them are in our own power, and that they are liable to fate, but are not caused by fate. In other words, we do have some power in our actions. I mean, there's this balance of Hashem's intervention in human affairs and our free will. Yeah. But the sect of the Essenes affirm that fate governs all things, and that nothing befalls man but what is according to its determination. This was the, as my understanding is, this was the faith of Islam. Some of the early Protestants maintained this. Martin Luther maintained this idea. This is an idea that the Rambam says in no uncertain terms in Hilchos Tshuva, that that this notion runs contrary to Judaism, because the whole idea of Judaism is that there is free will, that we have our power to do those, we have the power to do good and evil. As Rei Nesatil Fnecha Mayoim says, Chaim Ba'Movis, that Hashem gave us the power to choose life or death. And really, if one is fated to be a tzaddik, or one is fated to be a rasha, what difference does it make what you do? I mean, because it was fated to be so anyway. But this was the belief of the Essenes. And the Essenes were a very ascetic sect. Many of them did not marry at all. They're non-mainstream, non-traditional. And for the Sadducees, they take away fate and say there is no such thing. There's no hashgacha. And that the events of human affairs are not at its disposal, but they suppose that all our actions are in our own power. So that we are ourselves the causes of what is good and receive what is evil from our own folly. In other words, basically, God doesn't intervene in the affairs of human life, which does not make for very religious people. However, I have given a more exact account of these opinions in the second book of the Jewish War. Now we're going now to that account in section C. But the Sadducees are those that compose the second order. Notice, he went in this section, this chapter 8, he goes into great detail about the Essenes. I don't have the time you look at it, you think it's abandon mishagoyim. I mean, it's... No, we do not have... The only name of scenes that we have are taken from Josephus and also the work of Philo, the Alexandrian philosopher. We do not... There's a Maritz Chias mentions in his commentary on Masechta Brachos, Chavez Omed Aleph, he mentions a Tosefta that seems to allude to these Essenes. These Essenes were constantly going to the mikveh, much more so than what was common in that time. And there were... But besides that, which is questionable, that perhaps is the only allusion to these people at all. But we are going to next time we are going to see about what we call various sects amongst Jewry, further on based in the Gemara itself. Not perhaps called with the name Essenes, but we're going to find various. But the Sadducees are those that compose the second order and take away fate entirely. And suppose that God is not concerned in our doing or not doing what is evil. And they say that to act what is good or what is evil is at man's own choice, and that the one or the other belongs so to everyone, so that they may act as they please. See, it's very difficult from that standpoint to look at them as a sect of religious people. I mean, these are just amoral people. You know, the whole idea of Sadducees as we looked as a religious sect is patently false. Their religion was a national religion. It's a sense of identification. Just like there are people who keep some measure of Shabbos or Kashrus, not that they have any real religious feeling, but it gives them a sense of belonging, identification. But it's not really from a truly religious outlook. But they also take away the belief of the immortal duration of the soul and the punishments and rewards in Hades. In Gehenna. Moreover, the Pharisees, so they don't believe in the immortal duration of the soul. So here we have a people who said, really, God is not concerned about what we do. And when a person dies, that's the end. One can see for a very good cause, as the Rambam himself says, that these Sadducees, it wasn't just a question, they denied the oral Torah. They denied the Torah totally, because the whole Torah makes no sense. I mean, there was just an outward observance without any belief system. Moreover, the Pharisees are friendly to one another and for the exercise of concord and regard for the public. But the behavior of the Sadducees one to another is in some degree wild, and their conversation with those of their own party is barbarous, as they were strangers to them. And this is what I have to say concerning the philosophical sects amongst the Jews. It's some philosophy, but this is the... How did they get the name Sadducees, Sadducim? Where did it come from? Evidently, they coalesced on some sense of, you know... I mean, they should call themselves Shkotzim, you know? You know, what did they call themselves Sadducim for? Right. So I'd like to read, and this is to conclude this lecture, now, from August Rabnosson. Antigonus, the man of Socho, he was the one who was in the third mission in Pirkei Avos, that one should be a kavodem m'sham shemus arav shalom anas lekabel pras. One should serve Hashem without doing it for the profit motive, for reward. Had two disciples that studied and repeated his words and repeated them to their disciples, who in turn taught it to their disciples. So it became amongst their disciples, it became, you know, we know this from Tzaddik. As it could be a Talmud's Talmud already, and as the disciples' disciple. They, the disciples, arose and analyzed their words and commented. In other words, you know, they heard this from their Rebbe, or their Rebbe's Rebbe. How could our forefathers ever make such a statement that one should serve Hashem without the motivation of receiving reward? Is it possible that a laborer should not receive his wages at night? If our forefathers were aware of another world and of the resurrection of the dead, they would have never have to make such a statement. So basically, they maintain that this Tzaddik held the belief, mistakenly they mean, that there is no, don't serve for profit, for reward, because there is no reward. So they based themselves on that statement. It maybe was something they wanted to believe in any case, because if they, again, if one held the philosophy of the Tzaddikim, it really leads to a very libertarian form of living. You see, the Rabbonim say it. Milona Godel Mitzadik, the great rabbi said it. They arose and severed their ties to the Torah. Two breaches came out from them. Sadducees, the self-styled disciple of Tzadik, one of Antigonus' disciple, and the Baisusim, the self-styled disciples of Baisus, another disciple. Throughout their lives, the Sadducees would use only the finest vessels of silver and gold. They were gross and arrogant people. They would often say that the Pharisees have a tradition to torment themselves in this world. That's because he sees the Purushim were people of moderation and a certain sense of abstinence, and not to overindulge, without having anything in the next. In other words, they said, "Well, listen, if you're not going to, you know, if you're not going to have anything in the next, so you might as well enjoy it today." This was the philosophy of the Tzaddikim. So basically, when we speak about Tzaddikim, we're not dealing with another a sect of literalists, you know, fundamentalists who deny the oral law but hold precious the written law. There were such sects. I mean, recently the Karaites were very religious people, and they believed in life after death, and they believed in reward and punishment. But it's really a mistake to look at the Sadducees, Tzaddikim, as a religious sect. They were a band of shkutzim, and they were irreligious people who went along. And the Gemara says, there are several instances the Gemara quotes, that he says, even though that the Tzaddikim, because of pressure, did follow generally the guidelines of the general traditional community, at least when the people, the traditionalists, were in charge. When the traditionalists did not have the positions of power, they had the positions of power, they did what they wanted. But it would seem that there were various, he says that they're only the very rich. One would think it's a small percentage of the populace as a whole. 3%, 5%, whatever it is, a small percentage of the populace. And the bulk of the populace were Fulma Yidden. Not all of them, unfortunately, because of all the persecution, not all of them were very learned. But they knew, basically, that they had the sense of the truth of the Torah, of the idea of life after death, and they, as Josephus himself said, that they had the utmost trust in the Rabbonim. So this concludes this is the 12th lecture, and the Mir Tashem will continue on to the subsequent period of the sons of Yochanan Hyrcanus. Are there any questions? Yes.
When Yochanan was born, when he ever gave the Rabbanim, did they stop observing Hanukkah and they stopped wearing kippahs?
No, so that which was Torah law, they kept on observing. But it's Hanukkah, I don't know if they looked at it as an observance, as maybe as a national holiday, and after all, it was his parents, his uncles, who did this. They probably, you know, that was a sense of just as a national, spontaneous holiday, so to speak. But real, true observances, laws that the one was not allowed to, they did no longer kept. The idea of one has to cannot carry without an Erev. They probably did not keep. I mean, those kinds of laws. Yeah, right, those kinds of things. That's right. Everything rabbinical would strictly keep Torah alone. That was basically their approach. Yes?
With Demetrius.
Yes. Yes.
He made all of these treaties and titles
that
the value was Aristotle.
Well, at this point. Yeah, he just wanted him as an ally in fight. And as he had given up on this thing, he was really out of power. I mean, he was in and out. And he wanted him as an ally. He figured, I'll give up Yehuda, but at least I'll get the whole kingdom. So that's why Demetrius was willing to confer on him all these rights to have him as an ally. It's better to have a smaller thing and have a person as an ally than to have absolutely nothing. because it was in flux. Trypho was really in charge, so that because of the idea of flux, you know.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.